welcome to A Bookish Home. I'm Laura Zaro-Kopinski. This week, I'm sharing an interview with Elise Hooper, author of Learning to See, a novel of Dorothea Lange, the woman who revealed the real America. This is a truly inspiring historical fiction novel that will sweep you up into the life of an unforgettable, pioneering woman. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Elise Hooper, welcome to A Bookish Home. I'm so excited to have you on today.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Yes. So your new book is called Learning to See, a novel of Dorothea Lange, the woman who revealed the real America. And it is such a wonderful historical fiction book. I had totally fallen in love with your first book, The Other Alcott, and then was so happy to see you had a second one out and just enjoyed this one so much as well. So I'm excited to get to talk more about it. And for people who haven't gotten to read it yet, can you just tell us a little more about Dorothea Lange, her life and sort of how that, inspired the book?
Sure. I mean, not many real people's lives translate well into novels. Usually you have to do, a fair amount of imagining, right? Because we don't really want our lives to be novels because that means you've got a lot of struggle and drama and all that. But Dorothea Lange really is a great protagonist for a novel. She gives us a fascinating look into the lives of women, really through the 20s, 30s, 40s, and beyond. She was a pioneering photographer at a time when really women were not doing that kind of thing, especially once they married. Yet Dorothea maintained a career really from her early 20s until her death. And she starts out her life in the Northeast. She's born in Hoboken and attends high school in New York City, and then eventually makes her way to San Francisco. She's on a trip around the world with her best friend, and within 24 hours of being in San Francisco as they await their ship, they're pickpocketed, and they lose everything. And that really just struck me as a great time, a great moment with which to start this novel about this tenacious woman, because rather than deciding to go home with the tail between the legs, Dorothea decides to make San Francisco her new home. And within a couple of years, she has one of the city's most successful portrait photography studios. And so I had always known of Dorothea's work, her hard-hitting photos of the 1930s, her iconic photo, Migrant Mother. But as I was doing my research and came across this woman who had also run a successful business in the 20s as a portrait photographer, I was really fascinated by the transformation I thought needed to have happened in this woman to take her from really photographing San Francisco's well-heeled population into a real awakening to social justice and the photographs she took in the 30s and 40s and beyond that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. She really does. She seems to have lived 10 lives or something. There's so much there. But that was going to be, when you mentioned the pickpocketing, as soon as I read that at the beginning, I thought, did this really happen? Because first of all, it was heartbreaking. But then that sort of set the course for her life, because San Francisco does become where she sets up her business and where, you know, she really spends her adulthood. So that really happened? They were pickpocketed?
That happened, yes. I think they lost just over $500. I'd have to go back to, yeah, but right around that. And you're right. As I was doing my research too, that moment just jumped out at me. I knew that's where this novel begins. That's where that really does, just as you said, set the trajectory of her life.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you so feel for them in that moment, her and her friend, I think it's Franzi.
Yes.
You know, they're going to place after place, just trying to find somewhere to stay. And it's getting to the point where it's like, where are these two going to even sleep tonight? They were supposed to be on this, you know, lovely adventure around the world. And now they don't even have anywhere to stay. But yeah. And then you're right. She's so, she just has so much, you know, courage, and she's just very, just such a strong-willed person that where she takes that and finds a photography job and then turns that into the studio. And even the portrait studio, I'm sure you can tell us more about this too. It was like, oh, all of a sudden she has this beautiful studio and all of these clients. She She really kind of knows how to hustle as a businesswoman.
That's such a great word for her. She was a hustler, for sure. She didn't wait for things to come her way. She definitely went out and made her own luck. And I really think we can't underestimate the force of her personality. Many of her biographers write about just what a charming person she could be when she wanted. And I think she used all of that to establish what really becomes a very successful business through the 20s for her. And she really becomes kind of a woman to know in San Francisco. I mean, she was taking pretty modern photos for the time, in the sense that people, she didn't really want her subjects all dolled up and bejeweled. She wanted to try to capture a sense of their inner spirit. And so her photography, by comparison to much that had come before it, was actually pretty pared down. And she wanted people kind of staring off into the middle distance, looking thoughtful. And so she was doing things differently. And definitely she attracted a real following in the city of people who wanted to know her and wanted to be photographed by her. And she had these evening parties in her studio. I mean, she was really the place to be.
Well, it was interesting to see, too, the other photographers and artists that we know, like Ansel Adams, that she's interacting with. And she's in this camera club where she sort of has a different take on her photography than they do. Could you tell us about that a little bit and what you found out about this sort of circle she runs in?
Yes. Well, one thing that I always have to point out, because usually readers ask me about this, is Dorothea seemed to sort of know anyone who was anyone in this area. So you're absolutely right. She was friends with Ansel Adams. Her best friend becomes Imogen Cunningham, who herself was a renowned woman photographer all through the 1900s. She led a long life. And Edward Weston, and a number of women who started off with very interesting photography careers, and as they married, those careers ended. Dorothea and Imogen are really the only two who persist. But you're right. A lot of these peers of Dorothea's were very interested in the art, the technical aspects of photography. I have to say that that was not Dorothea's primary interest. She really wanted to capture people and their expressions and how they looked. I mean, she was always looking for kind of the story of her subjects. And so most of her peers all remained taking photographs really for all of their career, very much focused on art, abstractions of close-up objects, of landscapes, portraits. But Dorothea changed gears, especially when the 30s began and the economy had really dropped significantly, and it becomes the Great Depression. Dorothea wanted to capture what she felt like was really happening out on the streets. She saw her camera as an important tool to try to widen the world of Americans and raise awareness at what was happening, especially with people who really everyone wanted to ignore or look the other way, people who are facing tough times. Dorothea did not shy away from that. She felt a very important obligation to capture this.
Yeah, I thought that was so inspiring. And even just, I think it cut off for a second.
No problem. Oh, sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, I thought that was so inspiring. And even just watching, I thought it was so powerful to sort of see the signs of the effect the Depression's going to have on her family and her individual business. Was really interesting and difficult to read. And I think she probably would have said that she was much better off than a lot of people during the Depression, but still struggled and had to make some really hard choices. And, you know, it got me wondering what, you know, we have her photographs from that time of the pictures she was taking during the Depression, but what existed for you to help you figure out what her own family was going through and her own mindset? Like, I was curious sort of what primary source images or biographies or what is out there.
Yes. Well, Dorothea did not leave The record she left, really, of her own thoughts and feelings are largely discerned through her photographs. She did not write a memoir. She did not leave an extensive collection of letters behind or journal. So in that sense, for me, as a novelist, that makes her a great subject because I don't really want a ton of sources with her voice. And so what I turn to, aside from her photographs, which really inspire a lot of scenes in the book, I used an oral history she had left behind with the University of California. It's about 9 binders that can be found at the Museum of California in Oakland. And I used this documentary that she was part of called Grab a Hunk of Lightning. And she is interviewed during that. So I did get a sense of her and what she had to say about some of these choices she made and these periods of her life. And there are some great biographies on her. I'm often asked why I didn't write a biography on her. And honestly, that space is well filled. In particular, I really thought Linda Gordon's biography on Dorothea Lange, it's excellent. And so I was able to piece together Dorothea's life through all of these different pieces. Even the biography, which is a secondary source, you know, once you start combing through the endnotes, you can discover more primary sources in the forms of interviews she had done, Linda Gordon had done with other people. So using kind of triangulating in on all of these different sources, I set about creating a portrait of this woman that I thought was believable and compelling, that I thought would interest people today, because Dorothea's story in many ways is timeless. It really brings up so many tensions about country, about family, about independence, and about the struggle of women's lives and in juggling parenthood with ambition. And so there was so much rich material for me to work with.
Well, there's so much there. And I was just thinking, look, I was sort of looking back at the book today. It's the kind of book that you really want to discuss with other people. I was thinking it would definitely, I'm sure you're hearing from lots of people, they're using it for book clubs, but
yeah,
there's so many, I don't know, she makes so many difficult choices, and there's just so much richness to it that you really want to, you know, share it with other people and dissect it. But definitely one of the things I thought was most compelling, especially since you're sort of, you're looking at it through her eyes, is her struggles around definitely balancing parenthood and her career. And I know that was also kind of a theme in The Other Alcott. So I was kind of curious if that was something that drew you to Dorothea's life, or if that sort of, if it just sort of worked out that way, that they both, that both of those subjects, that there was a lot to do with that balance.
Well, I definitely, that is always a subject that interests me. I am a mother with 2 girls of my own. And I think any woman who, I think that interests so many women, of how people do it, how they juggle their family responsibilities with their creative ambitions or desires to produce work outside the home, or really even just juggle motherhood with individuality and cultivating a sense of self. I think these are all really compelling questions for me, and certainly for other women I know. So definitely this was a big part of the story that interested me about Dorothea. I think that she does give us a really interesting view into a time when women in many ways couldn't win. I mean, there really was not support for women who had ambitions that would take them to professional work outside of the home. And so Dorothea gives us a view of really stark choices that she had to make, because she was drawn to producing this other work. She felt that it was a really critical part of her that she couldn't ignore. I don't think she would have been a satisfied and fulfilled person had she not answered this sort of itch within her, this need. So So definitely that interested me as a mother and as a woman and as a human.
I was just going to say that was such a fascinating part of the book. And I think you mentioned in some of the material in the back, just how it's interesting to think about it in the context of her having no role models at the time who were working mothers, that there were no, you know, there's no daycare center. There's the options were so limited, especially, of course, she's trying to do this important work, but it's the depression and money is tight. And I thought there was just so much there. And you know, it's difficult to read about, you know, some of the fallouts in her relationships with her kids as a result. But you look at the contributions that she makes, and you know, I had seen the migrant mother picture, mm-hmm. and if listeners can't picture it, I think once you see it, and I can try to put a link. I don't know if there's a way to link to it in my show notes, but I think once people see it, they'll recognize it. But I didn't realize that she had also photographed the Japanese internment camps during World War II. Yeah. It's a whole other layer to the story.
Right. And that was actually the other part of the story that really interested me. I live in Seattle, and that's a big part of my area's history now. I mean, many families were relocated from this area. The International District in Seattle really never recovered its Japanese population after the war. And so I think that while here we're pretty well steeped in some of the history of that, certainly other parts of the country aren't. And I did, you know, it's the former English and history teacher in me just felt compelled to add that part of the story in a way to try to teach people a bit about what happened then. And again, I just think it shows how Dorothea was so forward-thinking in many ways, where she saw what was happening and really was appalled by what the government was doing. And so her photographs were pretty subversive. And as a result, she was fired for them. And other photographers, including Ansel Adams, who were more compliant with the government's wishes, took on the job instead. And so I think part of there are a couple of reasons we don't often associate Dorothea with the Japanese internment the way we do her work with the 30s, for sure. And that is partly because her photographs were impounded and really kind of disappeared into the Library of Congress for many decades. Her photographs of Manzanar and some of the other camps were, the government did not want people to see them, especially initially. So that's one reason. And the other thing is that she didn't get a byline from the government for much of her work, even her work like Migrant Mother in the 30s. So her name has kind of been lost to history in some ways. I mean, everyone recognizes her work, but no one knows anything really about the woman behind the camera. And so that's what also just made her a great subject. Just her name is not widely known. When I tend to tell people, oh, when I was working on the novel, oh, I'm writing a book about Dorothea Lange, I tended to get a pretty blank stare from whoever I was talking to. And it wasn't till I'd pull up Migrant Mother on my cell phone and people would say, oh, yes, of course, I know her. But no one, again, really knows of her name. So I really wanted to play a small part in trying to raise her profile and have people understand more about this remarkable life.
Yeah, I mean, that was for sure my experience. I really had only known the photograph, and now to see all the contributions she made and really the sacrifices that she made to raise awareness through her photography, I thought was really inspiring. And, you know, as you're talking about sort of, well, I guess first I did want to ask more. So her work in the 30s and during World War II, she was working for the government. And I guess I had never really put together that a lot of the photos, you know, that I had seen, like Migrant Mother, I guess I don't know who I thought was taking them, but I wasn't thinking about them being photographers hired by the government. Could you tell us a little bit about those programs? Yes.
That's a great question. That always kind of mystifies people. But yes, during the 1930s, under FDR, he formed a variety of different bureaus and government agencies, all aimed at trying to provide relief for Americans who were struggling. And as part of that, the RA, then later renamed the FSA, developed this photography unit. And the job for these people was to travel around the country and photograph Americans who were struggling in many ways. And part of that was so that these photos would be available to newspapers as part of the record of what was happening in this country. But really, newspapers and magazines used this, then what becomes kind of like this huge repository of photographs to accompany news articles. I mean, Dorothea's work, for example, accompanied John Steinbeck's articles, The Harvest Gypsies, which eventually is what he cultivates into The Grapes of Wrath. So her work was being drawn upon by the media primarily. And also it would go into government reports. The economist she ends up meeting, who really opens her to this whole work, this whole job for the government, was a man named Paul Taylor, and he was an economist at the University of California in Berkeley, but he served in a variety of positions with the government, and he would go about, especially California, documenting the state of migrant workers. Originally, of course, they expected to see these mostly Mexican families coming up north of the border to find work, but what they realize is that it's actually a lot of people pouring in from the middle of the country. You know, it's taking everyone a little bit to piece together what's happening in the Dust Bowl is then affecting places like California. And so that was Dorothea's work in the 30s is really for this government agency that is supporting the media and creating this sort of record of what was happening in the country. And then during the war, this is always really what mystifies people is why in the world did the government want to document the Japanese internment? But they did want a record to show that it was a peaceful, what should I call it? Like movement that the people who were being interned were compliant, that there was nothing to worry about. In fact, they gave Dorothea very strict orders. Do not photograph soldiers, do not photograph guns, barbed wire, guard towers, nothing that would make these look like concentration camps, like what's happening in Germany. Well, of course, Dorothea saw that that wasn't entirely the case, and she tried to take photos. She pushed the limits of the censors really as best she could. And I think those photographs were always meant to just kind of live on as these sort of government records so that they could show what happened. I mean, they've taken on a variety of different of kind of lives of their own since then, and they're very relevant today, even, I think, with what's happening on our borders and internment camps that are being built today to house people. This is definitely an interesting time of maybe not history exactly repeating itself, but it sure kind of sounds similar to what was happening in the 40s.
Yeah, there's so many parallels. And as you're reading, I mean, I'm sure everyone's education is a little bit different, but I just felt like, you know, for all the times we studied World War II, I feel like the Japanese internment was always like a page or two in the textbook and certainly not delved into in depth. And it was just to watch her being censored in that way. It was just, I don't know. It just felt so calculated, and it's just such a shameful part of our country's history. But, you know, one of the things that it was getting me thinking about too, you know, as she goes on in her career, she does, you know, become more well-known. But I know you're saying that because she doesn't have the byline, people don't know as much about her now. Have there been, like, if people want to view her photographs and get more like a nonfiction take, where would they go for that? I'm sure as time has gone on, there is, you know, hopefully more work going into giving her photos and her work the due they deserve.
Yes. Well, that's a great prompt. First of all, people can go to the Library of Congress's website and start searching for Dorothea Lange, and her work will start popping up. And really, work through the 30s and into the 40s will all become, I mean, there are thousands of images. So that is one source. Again, I would recommend Linda Gordon's biography on her, which is called Dorothea Lange, A Life Beyond Limits. Linda Gordon also produced a really interesting book called Impounded that is specifically a look at Dorothea and the Japanese internment and includes many of her photos. And there's also this great documentary I mentioned earlier, which is called Grab a Hunk of Lightning. And it was part of the PBS sort of American Masters series. And it can be found online. And I believe Amazon Prime has it available these days. And if you can't find it there, the first place I ever took it out from was my local library. So
there you go.
and it's great. It's about an hour and a half. It includes some clips of Dorothea Lange talking about her life. It has many of her family members and friends and historians. It's really wonderful. And a lot of people I know who have read the book have then gone and watched that and to kind of deepen their understanding.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah. And then someone who people always ask me about after finishing the novel is Maynard Dixon, her first husband. And he was just this fascinating figure to me because his artwork is so beautiful. And he's kind of a name I would also say has been sort of lost to history, I think for many reasons. Church of Latter-day Saints scooped up a large part of his collection at the end of the 30s for a song. So you can find his original artwork for the most part at Brigham Young University. But you can visit websites like the Thunderbird Foundation and learn more about him through that. And I really encourage people to do that because I think you have to see his artwork, even if it's online, to kind of really understand the romance of this man and really kind of understand the colorful nature of him and maybe what drew Dorothea to him originally.
Yeah, I love that idea. So much of the book is so visual, so to be able to follow up with looking at some of that would be great. Yeah. Well, I have to also ask, because I first came to your work through The Other Alcott, and you had picked such another interesting subject for that, May Alcott, and I'm a huge Little Women fan, and I loved that you sort of... Yeah, I loved that you had kind of decided to shine a light on the other Alcott sister.
Right.
Could you talk about that a little bit and how you came to want to write about her?
Oh, sure. I mean, that one is an easy one. I grew up right outside of Concord, Massachusetts, and I had visited Orchard House many times as a girl for open houses around the holidays. I even went to drama camp at Orchard House.
Oh,
and yeah. And I had read, I read all of Louisa's books, as many as I could get my hands on, either at our own house or at the library at school. Town library. And honestly, it was visiting Orchard House and going into Louisa's bedroom up on the second floor and first seeing that little desk at which she wrote Little Women and Two Feverish Months. I mean, really, when I saw that desk, I must have been about 9 or 10 years old. I was kind of like, wow, people write books. Like, that can be a job. And I remember just thinking, wow, that could be the neatest job ever. I think I had, up to that point, it sounds so rudimentary, but I really think I thought books just sort of appeared on bookshelves and I'd never imagined sort of the people behind the books. And so just like I needed to kind of understand this woman behind the camera, I needed to understand these women behind the book. And, you know, I started that novel, quite honestly, thinking I'd be writing about Louisa because she's the iconic author we all know about. But really, her voice was so well established in her own work, and she did leave behind such a rich record of her life through letters and journals that I kind of discovered there really wasn't enough room in my imagination for her. And that's when I remember that little bedroom in the back of Orchard House with the sketches on the walls that was, in fact, May's bedroom. And I thought, what happened to that sister? What about this young woman who really the world knows is kind of the comic foil, the little brat in Little Women? What was her real story? And I was not at all disappointed by what I discovered. I mean, she led a fascinating life of her own, in her own right, that she pursued art at a time when women did not do that, when most art schools would not let women in. She cultivated the sisterhood of other women artists, first in Boston and then in Europe. And I just discovered this whole other world that really fascinated me and that provided such rich information for me to imagine. That was a really fun novel to write. It started as really a passion project on the Alcotts and became just this whole exploration of women artists in the 1870s. And, you know, that's just a fascinating time in art history, what with the Impressionists beginning. And it's just a rich period to explore.
Yeah, it was such a fun book to read. And it's true. I mean, she lived this, you know, interesting life that I would not have expected at all. And I had, you know, I lived near Concord as well. And I didn't go to Orchard House until I was an adult. But it is such a magical place. And I had been so captivated by the real Alcotts, but for some reason, never really learned that much about May. And I actually went back after reading the other Alcott to look again at the sketches on the walls and noticed so much more a second time around when you take the tour, how much of May's artwork is all throughout the house. And did you get to research there at all for the book?
Oh, yes. Yes. I traveled back there many times while I was working on the novel, and the staff at Orchard House was wonderful. They were very helpful. And so I was able to, there is a small journal that May kept kind of toward the end of her life. And they let me read through that. And so, yes, so Orchard House and the people there who lived to keep the Alcotts very much alive for fans were a huge help. And I really have to tell people that is a site that is such a wonderful spot to visit. I really think you get a sense for that family when you visit the home, and it's just filled, you're right, with all these artifacts, and you cannot walk in there and kind of not start getting a sense of who these people were. And I always love, I've gone on a million of their tours before, and I have to say, I always love it. You can always see a few men have been sort of dragged along by their wives who are big Little Women fans, or a few dads who are brothers. Yep. And they, you know, they always start off looking kind of bored and put upon, but by the end, they are always asking the most questions. I mean, this is a really interesting family who was, again, very ahead of their times in many ways, very quirky. So I always love seeing that definitely a few people wander into that tour not expecting very much, but they always end up, I believe, pretty captivated.
Oh, for sure. It's so worth it. And yes, I have definitely dragged my husband there multiple times. I brought my daughter in the little carrier when she was a baby, just like, okay, maybe she'll absorb some of this. But yes, it almost feels sacred when you're there if you're a Little Women fan. And I will mention, I'll put a link in the show notes. I actually interviewed the director of Orchard House, Jan Turnquist, and encouraged people to go to Orchard House in another episode. It's so worth a visit, even if you're traveling from very far away. So people can definitely check that out. But have picked up Learning to See, I hope they also pick up the other Alcott as well. And I'm just such a fan of your books, and the subjects you have picked so far have been so fascinating, and it led me to be curious if you have an idea for a next historical fiction character, or if that might still be top secret. But
no, I was just at work on it. No, that is fine. I am currently writing a novel about early women Olympians.
Oh.
Yes, it's just a really fun, but also pretty, these women led amazing lives. I'm specifically focusing on three early women sort of track stars who all come together to essentially race in Hitler's 1936 Olympics in Berlin. And, you know, that's the Olympics we know a fair amount about through great nonfiction books like The Boys in the Boat or Unbroken. We know that was Jesse Owens' big Olympics, but there were women there too, and they have incredible stories that I'm so excited to share with readers. So I'm working away at a feverish pace on that one, and we're planning for that book to come out in summer of 2020, which should coincide with the next Olympics in Tokyo.
Oh, perfect. Well, I will so look forward to that. You just do such a wonderful job illuminating these women's lives. I definitely will look forward to the next one.
Thank you.
Well, just to end, I love to hear what writers are reading. Is there a book you've read lately that you'd want to recommend to listeners?
Yes. I am so excited about Daisy Jones and the Six right now by Taylor Jenkins Reid. Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. I love that book.
I love that author so much. It's been on my list. I haven't actually picked that one up yet, but
you're in for a treat.
Ooh,
yes, it's great. I have actually listened now. I downloaded recently the new Libro FM, the sort of audiobook app from independent booksellers, and you can actually set it to your favorite local independent bookstore, and so that I think they get a large part of the proceeds of your purchase. But I listened to Daisy Jones and the Six, and it is a fabulous audiobook. It's got a full cast, and you know, it's written to be an oral history, so it just sounds so great in audio with all these different actors and actresses reading the parts. It's terrific. I highly recommend it. You know, a rock band in the 70s, what is not to be intrigued by? It's really fun and fascinating. And she really builds a very believable world. She was in Seattle as part of her book tour when I was on the East Coast, and I was so disappointed. I would love to have gone and heard her talk about how she developed the story. It's a great one.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, yes. And I love to hear that it's great on audio. It's always nice to find a good audiobook, but she's such a wonderful author too. Well, I'll definitely link to that in the show notes if people are interested. Annalise, where can people find you and follow you if they want to learn more about you and your books?
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. I have a website, which is elisehooper.com. I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, and I'm on Instagram. I would definitely say Instagram is probably where I'm the most active because I like pictures, and especially I think since I have been writing about artists, I try to include, I have some of Maynard's paintings on there and Dorothea's photographs, so I try to give some backstory through my Instagram on the people I'm writing about. And I try to give a glimpse of my process in those days where I feel like I spend hours just moving commas around. Not all just, these books don't just write themselves. But I try to respond to people's questions and emails and all of that. So I would love to hear from readers at all times.
Wonderful. Well, it was so great to learn more about Learning to See and to get to chat with you today. So thanks for coming on.
Thank you. It was great to speak with you. I really appreciate it.
I hope you go pick up Learning to See at your local bookstore or library. To learn more about Elise Hooper, you can visit her website, elisehooper.com, or follow her on Instagram at Elise Hooper. For links to all of the books mentioned on this week's episode, and for more book recommendations, you can head to my website, abookishhome.com. If you have not yet taken a moment to subscribe or write a review for the podcast, I would so appreciate it. You can do that in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening and happy reading!